good afternoon. We're in my study with boxes up to the ceiling. We're still in Scotland.
But we're moving very soon down to England.
In just 2 days. But we wanted to bring this conversation we've been having on purity culture and skewed sexual attitudes.
This was actually a conversation that started about a month ago, and it's mushroomed and it's grown, and we just sort of sense the spirit's been working here in the last few days.
Right. You remember a few conversations ago, we talked about the lens of Matthew 28. If evangelism is everything, that can cause some fairly serious distortions. We've received a lot of feedback that we've really appreciated. I'd like to read one of the letters before we talk about another lens. And this letter is actually sent by a former church member. Thank you, Douglas and Vicky, for your conversation series. The ones on the Matthew 28 lens and personal fruitfulness have most resonated with me. I'm grateful that some in the church have realized that the scripture has been used to berate and shame disciples and has been the be-all and end-all. I left the church in large part because of the emphasis on being salesmen for Christ. Nothing else matters, not grace, nor love, nor fruits of the Spirit, or anything. Every sermon our minister preached, and I do mean every sermon, was about evangelism and how we can do better. There were other issues as well, such as lack of compassion and support. And I wonder how many people who really love God were driven away by that sole focus on numbers and that, quote, you're risking your salvation if you don't reach out to somebody every single day, end quote. And that's from a discipling partner. I pray that the leadership will pay attention and focus on other aspects of following Jesus.
Wow, that's quite a letter.
Salesman for Christ.
But also mentioning the shame, that culture of shame. And I've heard of other things that are even slightly stronger than that, that if someone has died, that maybe it was somebody outside of the faith that you had known but you hadn't shared with, that responsibility was now on your shoulders. And this lens really got too personal and too judgmental.
Their blood was on you?
That sort of thing, yes. And especially with young people, it was very, very hard. And I saw that a lot.
Yes, so to be honest, until Vicky and I started talking about this, I hadn't realized this power of the sexual lens that we're going to be exploring. And notice that Vicky had brought this up in a number of conversations, really in the last few months, so we started talking about it recently. I was looking at Christianity Today. Christianity Today is an evangelical magazine. It'll keep you up to date with what's going on. And I noticed they were promoting a new book by Zachary Wagner called Non-Toxic Masculinity, Recovering Healthy Male Sexuality. And it looked intriguing, but what really caught my eye was an endorsement. It's another author who's endorsing the book is Christian Kobe Dume, who is the author of Jesus and John Wayne, which was excellent. And I was privileged to be part of an interview with her. She talks about, and she's an historian, but she explains how in the evangelical world, the view of what is a real man has changed a lot, moved way, way from the Bible, particularly since the 1970s. It's an incredible book. And so I ordered it. I was in the U.S. A couple weeks ago. It came just a couple hours before I went to the airport. It was amazing, this book. I'm sure you want to read it too, but...
I've started to read a few things, but the packing has been overtaking at this point. But it dovetailed perfectly with the conversation I've been having with Doug about how I think the focus on sexual purity and sexual sin, I'm not saying that that isn't wrong, but the focus that we had, and I think especially with young people, the focus on dating became very controlling, and it was a very narrow lens, and it's really shamed a lot of people for something that is actually quite natural.
Because I think I've realized that the way I viewed myself, the way I viewed others, or tried to train others, disciple them, has been affected by, well, it's called purity culture. Now, I wasn't even familiar with that term, although it describes something that's decades old, and that became particularly powerful in the 1990s. And you said you had not heard of it until recently either, huh?
No, I hadn't really put two and two together, but it was some of it was from my observations. And yet once we started reading the book and started having further discussions, then we started to realize, oh, this was something that's very much affected our churches and our church families.
I realize that not everyone listening in is in the United States, but I think we're all affected by North American culture. And so just a really quick review. What happened in the 1960s? This is the baby boomers. This is mainly the generation born in the 40s and 50s. You have the sexual revolution, liberation, Woodstock, the homosexual revolution, divorce, abortion becomes easy, the disintegration of the nuclear family. And the evangelical church is quite afraid and start pushing back, as you could imagine they would.
I think that was really out of fear that a lot of these things, again, it was with good intention. It was like, and I think a lot of it would be evangelical women having had bad experiences in the 60s and 70s thinking, I don't want this to happen to my children, so let's start setting some of these boundaries. And the church has just got on that bandwagon as well.
And in a way, I think there was an overreaction, but it's hard to, well, let's say it's easy to be quite critical, but it is quite scary. This is a time when drugs are proliferating on the streets, where free sex is everywhere, abortions are everywhere. This is a very scary time.
It is a scary time. And again, I think it's like a lot of things. We've had good ideas as a society, even as a Christian movement, but we haven't understood what they would do or that someone's going to take it to the nth degree and it becomes controlling.
Well, so what is purity culture? There are a number of elements, but really it is a reaction to the sexual revolution of the 60s and 70s. One idea, of course, is that women and girls are dangerous, and men need to be really careful or they'll get sucked into sin. Because after all, boys, men will stray.
And it's acceptable that men will stray, but girls are the ones. And you see it happening and starting very early on, about talking about how they dress, about their appearance, what they need to do and what they need to say.
You know, Matthew 5 warns of the dangers of looking lustfully at a woman, but the responsibility is, in that passage, clearly placed on the man. It's not, therefore, it's the woman's job to dress a certain way, and if the man stumbles, then the woman should be punished. I mean, kind of like in fundamentalist Islam, where the woman would be punished. No, it's the man's responsibility.
Right.
But men are viewed as being so weak, so animalistic. They're, you know, controlled by their hormones, whereas women are more together. They're less sexual, which is probably not even true. Anyway, that's the basic idea about men and women.
Probably women express their sexuality, I think, in different ways. And again, it's more surrounding about the act of sex rather than sometimes just understanding that we're sexual beings. It just becomes focused on the act.
Right. Sex is not intercourse. Sex is connection. It's communication. It's much more than just
a function, which is what, sadly, this culture has really shaped it to be.
Two of the very influential books we should probably mention. There's Every Man's Battle by Arthur Byrne and Stoker, which many men will have read, I'm sure. And then Joshua Harris wrote a couple of books. One was called Kiss Dating Goodbye.
I really came into contact with that book when we had teenagers, because that was being recommended, especially for the boys to read that book. But it was a rough book, and it was I think had good intentions, but it was very narrow.
Yeah, this idea that of not kissing, for example, not just not dating, but not kissing your fiancé until you are actually married. In other words, in the church wedding. And I've attended a number of weddings where people have said, and now we're having our very first kiss.
Right. To me, I became aware of that in the 1990s. I heard about it and I was thinking, oh, where did that come from? And then it became such a thing. And
mark of honor almost. Like
this was the big thing, and that this is the first kiss. And there have been sad things that a lot of us have seen where somebody doesn't even know how to give somebody a kiss in the wedding. And it's embarrassing, but it's also putting incredible pressure on what should be a natural growing and being able to be together, it all becomes focused on one event.
Yeah, it's not like all affection is sinful until you're married.
Right. And I think out of that came a sense that, or I remember hearing a lot about this, is that, you know, you don't want to pray with somebody because you'll draw too close to them and it will make you have struggle sexually. And then that starts...
Yeah, I remember...
twisting.
Well, I think the advice that was given back in the 80s was, don't pray. Prayer will bring you very close together. Don't pray until you're actually engaged. It wasn't like that was forbidden until marriage. But I thought, oh, well, that kind of makes sense because it does draw you close and you do want to be careful. And besides, if you're dating, not engaged, there's no, it's not like a commitment to marry.
But again, it would depend what you're praying about. I think it doesn't make sense to me because prayer is not something sexual. And if you're talking about wanting to find out if you've got a spiritual relationship, which is what you would be hoping for as a Christian, that seems to be, I don't know, it just seems to, doesn't make sense a lot of times. That probably somebody did mess up because they were praying, but it depends what you were praying for. And that sense that it happened to somebody, therefore everyone's going to do it, and that lack of trust, I think, really brought a lot of shame and reproach on people.
I mean, the idea that all men will stray or all women are dangerous, again, I think that's much more, well, it's become a kind of a right-wing evangelical attitude now, but it's more of a fundamentalist Muslim idea than a biblical idea. And it dehumanizes. Zachary Wagner's book, Non-Toxic Masculinity, does a great job showing how that dehumanizes women, making them objects, and men as well. There are lots of negative sides. Do you want to talk about the kind of the misguided spirituality that comes from this?
Yeah, I think we started to see examples of this, as I said, really when our kids were teens, and we would, things they would come home and tell us that they'd heard in teen ministries, and we'd be like, wait a minute, where did you get that from? You know, I remember one of our girls being in a discipleship group, and they were reading a book where it was really promoting kind of romanticizing your relationship with Jesus. These were 16-year-old girls. And I asked the teen leader about it, and they were like, oh, well, I think it's a good book for them because they just had gone through a breakup and this will help them be sexually pure.
This is the book about Jesus being your boyfriend?
Yes.
Oh, and I was, right.
And I don't remember the title, but just that idea, I was like, that's not the Jesus that I see in the scriptures. And I think that's a dangerous area. But again, it was trying to be that feel-good Christianity, like you don't need a boyfriend.
If someone's doing well spiritually, there are a huge number of passages that would describe that person. You think of someone who's growing in knowledge and faith in 2 Peter 1, or the compassion, the love that we clothe ourselves with, Colossians 3, or the fruit of the Spirit, Galatians 5. But we've talked about this in previous conversations. In performance thinking, you're really only doing well spiritually if you're showing up to church and you're evangelistic, you're reproducing yourself, which is not wrong, but that's such a small part of the whole.
What do you think it does mean to, what does it mean to be doing well spiritually then?
I would say to be doing well spiritually means that we are coming to resemble in our character Jesus Christ more and more. And I would base that on the Sermon on the Mount. I would base that on Romans 8:29 and those other passages I was just
But that's hard to control, isn't it? Because then you're talking about something that's growing on the inside. It's not necessarily showing.
Oh, yeah.
Well, it will show on the outside because you would be more likely to be obedient if you're understanding that inward grace.
I guess you can fake some things. You can pretend to be compassionate.
Yeah. But I do think we're misguided a lot of times because we would look very much at the outside, at that performance, and what,
right.
And then think if you get the outside right, and then a special, you know, and you're not having any sexual struggles, then the inside is right.
Right. So it's about compliance. So the markers of someone doing well spiritually would be, you know, activities and especially evangelistic activity, and then on the negative side, avoiding sin, but particularly sexual sin. It wasn't that. You know, someone struggled with pride or anger, if someone was struggled with materialism, that may or may not even be brought up. But sexual sin, and particularly what was called impurity, a word that's in the Bible, but became a code word, I think it became a code word for masturbation. Would you say impurity?
And perhaps thoughts or looking at impure things in the internet. And we have to remember that the internet has a huge role to play in all of this.
Right. But the definition is it's too narrow. You know, in Psalm 119, how can a young man keep his way pure? Well, basically, you put the word in your heart. The idea in the purity culture is that the solution to temptation is to memorize scripture. And that may help some. I'm not sure how effective that is in fighting sexual impulses, but I doubt very much that that verse in Psalm 119 is talking about sexual sin. A young man keeping his way clean is much broader than just a sexual thing.
Right, it's much more of an idea of being on the right path here, isn't
right,
it?
Yeah. And
on a narrow path rather than the wide path.
But the wisdom that comes down from heaven, James 3, is first of all pure. And I don't think that's a statement about sexuality. It's about, it's not contaminated with worldly elements. And if you read James 3, it's only 18 verses.
It's God's purity.
I mean, it's right.
God. It's reflecting God because God is pure, that sense of pure light.
Right. So it's not that sexual purity is not a kind of purity, but purity is so much more than that. But I think people are conditioned to hear the word purity or impurity, and immediately they think of something sexual.
Yes, because that's what the purity culture has done. And I know there were times when I heard of people getting purity rings. Or I think even in teen ministries, there was the sense of, you in America, it's typical that you have these proms at the end of school, and a lot of places would ban their kids from, you know, their teens from going to these proms because they were going to be impure, and how would other people be dressing and other people behaving?
Yeah.
And yet it was such a part of society. But again, there was this focus that you'll be impure and you'll be tempted if you go.
Well, for that reason, I think many churches organize their own proms.
Right, and those some got called purity balls or something like that.
Purity ball. Okay, this is a ball where there'll be no sex. No. How would you put that in the brochure?
But I think that these things, like I said, you know, we started to become aware of them with our kids. I remember another one of our children actually going to prom. It depended on who your group of friends were, and she got a lovely group of friends. But I remember that there was just these incredibly strict guidelines, and I think afterwards it was another time where she went to prom, and there was an after prom party afterwards. And honestly, she went with her friends. I knew the friends, I knew the parents, but they weren't from quote unquote our church. They went to different churches, but we never let the teen leaders know. It sounds so sad. It sounds like you're going behind it, because that was against the rules.
Oh, because it was a different group.
Because it was a different group, and yet I knew that these were a great group of kids.
Because you're talking about character, not church affiliation, which may or may not have anything to do with character.
Nothing to do with character.
Something about guidelines. We talked in our second conversation, the one after the intro, when we looked over the last 20 years, about the crossroads phase of our parts of the Church of Christ. And that phase lasts up till the late 70s, overlapping into the 80s. And then there was the Boston phase up into the early 90s, and then the ICOC phase. In the crossroads phase, there were definitely dating guidelines. Probably rules is more accurate, but it was double dating.
Yeah, that was before my time, so you don't have to speak about that.
Well, you were alive, but yeah, you were too young to date. I'm a little older than Vicky.
I became
a Christian a little bit earlier.
But
the idea of double dating, when I was baptized 1977, and someone suggested that I invite someone on a date, I thought that that was unspiritual. That wasn't because of Joshua Harris. That was well before his time. I just thought Christians would date, and there was a banquet, and I was encouraged to bring somebody. It was so hard. I eventually changed my mind. So I may have even...
Yeah, Doug definitely changed his mind, because Doug gave me a kiss even before we were dating. Now, that didn't mean that our relationship was impure, but he broke all the rules by that stage. He changed.
Oh, that's
But that's
right.
Okay.
I think I remember where that was.
Along the River Thames.
That's right.
Anyway, okay. But that's many
Stop
years
sharing.
Ago now.
I don't want to cause our listeners to struggle here. But in the Boston phase, I think things became a little bit stricter, but there was also a lot more sin. And in the next phase, from the 90s on, as purity culture is gaining traction in North America, books like Joshua Harris's books were being promoted.
And well, one of the crazy, and the internet was...
Oh, and the internet.
We'll come to that, we don't know how to deal with that.
Yeah, but for Joshua Harris, I think it's probably worth saying this. Now, to his credit, Zachary Wagner in Non-Toxic Masculinity refers to Harris two or three times, but he doesn't actually mention that Harris reneged on his position, even apologized to people. Harris doesn't even identify as a Christian anymore. And when for Joshua Harris, the author of these books that were given to many of our children, basically recanted his whole position, that was probably hard.
The early 2000s when that Joshua's book was out.
But that hurt people, didn't it?
It did really hurt people.
Well, there's been a culture of shame that's created. It's not just from unrealistic evangelistic expectations, but from being out of sync with what human nature is and what makes us fully human, the sexual side. And we'd like to talk a little bit more about that, this culture of shame, the sense of, I never measure up. I'm always unclean. I'm a bad person. I'm bad. My body is bad.
And, well, also that sex is bad, or even having a sex drive or being in touch with your sexuality, even as a teen, it was almost like when they're going through puberty, they're going to be all over the place, but there was no tolerance for that. It was like, this is where your sin will lead you. You know, you're going to become this sort of prolific sexual predator almost if you don't get control of this now. And it really damaged, especially the boys, I think.
And as you mentioned a few minutes ago, it's so much more difficult now with the internet, TV, shopping malls. You know, even the over-sexualization of children, gender dysphoria, little kids being encouraged to explore, you know, what's their gender preference. You add all of that in with disillusionment about church, especially organized religion. It's quite a difficult time for adolescents to deal with these things.
I think it's difficult for all of us because we've all become so informed and we're trying to figure out what's the difference between information, what's truth.
Yeah,
and
disinformation.
Yeah, disinformation. And then along with that now we have fake news. I mean, every few years something new comes out and we're just grappling with that. And so I think that's a reason why they sort of battened down the hatches, and this sort of advice was like, out of fear, sex is bad.
You know, it's incredible to me. You know, Vicky and I are not, we're not young, but we look back at church leaders and many who planted and led churches were still technically adolescents. You know, that frontal lobe was still developing. They were too young to rent a car. And it was a comment you made when we were driving back from Edinburgh the other day. Maybe there's a good reason Jesus didn't start his ministry till he was 30. I mean, I think there are multiple reasons, but he would be much more stable then. You know, he wouldn't have been hormonal like an adolescent. So it's scary that...
I think there's a lot of wisdom in that and why he was respected. But I also think as young people, we were put in position. We were pretty young ourselves. And there was this sense that the Bible's got the answers and you have the Spirit, and so your answers are biblical or they're good and sound. And I think a lot of crazy advice has been given and a lot of misunderstandings.
To hire a car, you have to be 26. If you remember, when I was married, I was 26 and 4 days old. So I was mature.
Oh, I thought it was 25, but there we go. Oh,
I thought it was over 25. Well, how about this? You know, marriage is always portrayed as the solution, you know, for the boys. The solution to your sexual temptations is get married and then you can have sex.
Well, and then you won't be tempted. And I remember this was in the 90s telling someone, that's not true. You're now going to be sexually active. You're definitely going to have more temptation. But this sense put so much pressure on marriages. And
you could have more or less. I guess it depends on how you're wired physiologically. But it's certainly an untruth. And then for the girls, putting so much stock in the wedding itself.
Yeah, and television has added to that about all about the dress. It's all about the day. And and also, I think there's so much pressure on people to, they don't want to be labeled. It's become a badge of shame almost to be in the singles ministry or the single professional ministry.
Something that Wagner talks about in his book, what's a phrase, I don't know if he made it up, the sexual prosperity gospel. You know, we rightly deride and reject the prosperity gospel. Health and wealth is yours if you follow God. But to put it all, put all of this on marriage. Marriage is where you're going to have the best sex possible. Christian sex is better than non-Christian sex, and so forth. And you'll be living together happily ever after. Is a dream that's really doesn't resonate with reality.
Well, and along with that is that only Christian marriages are decent marriages. Everyone else has got terrible marriages, and that's not true. And
no,
people
not necessarily.
Start to realize that that's not it. And a lot of Christian marriages end up with problems because the whole focus, unfortunately, has been on sex.
Right. So the point that marriage isn't for everyone is one that's been noted not just by Wagner, but by many of us who've been writing. The Bible doesn't say you have to get married. The Bible is very countercultural. In much of the world, if you're not married, yeah, you're damaged goods, or you're just not respected, as if you don't have children, or if you do have children but you don't have a son. The Bible rejects these. That's not right. Marriage is not for everyone, and Jesus and Paul are quite clear about that. And if you're going to say that that's the dream to be married, well, what about Jesus? If you can't be a complete human being without sex, was Paul incomplete? Was Jesus Christ incomplete?
These are all very interesting questions.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's interesting, too, that we've also seen incredible rise in divorces as well. And I think that's related to this purity culture, because as women are getting more educated, they're starting to realize they're in marriages where there's abuse, there's unfaithfulness, but they're expected to stay in those marriages because of this purity culture. And now they're starting to understand that, oh, this is not
right.
What Jesus is talking about.
And I don't think we've not done a conversation on this yet, but our understanding of marriage and divorce and remarriage is that if a man or woman breaks the wedding vows, is unfaithful in that way, there may be grounds for divorce. It's not just desertion or adultery. To say that unless you have sexual intercourse with someone, she can't divorce you. You can basically do whatever you want, any kind of kinky or unfaithful thing. But unless you, quote, go all the way, end quote, she's stuck with you. And
well,
sadly, that is taught in many fundamentalist churches and in many churches of Christ, most, I'd say.
And we've seen tremendous unfaithfulness. I mean, the rise of pornography, obviously, with the internet and people having, incredible addictions. I know it. You get women as well into pornography, but it does tend towards the men. But that's an unfaithfulness. That's breaking a covenant bond
right there.
And yet women are told, you need to stay, and it was your fault because you didn't meet his sexual needs. And
right, you deprived him. It wasn't mutual consent, 1 Corinthians 7. So, and to make it worse, you have leaders who've been held...
Use those verses, too.
Well,
they hold you to them.
Mistaught a lot of verses, but many leaders were held up as great examples, great Christians, but we learned that they weren't living by these principles, and we've seen in our churches a tremendous amount of sexual sin, financial impropriety, of disciple abuse, of control, and of divorce as well. We were talking about one young Christian woman and her ministry. This all took place in a period of just, I think, a few months. Her campus minister and his wife divorced. Imagine the impact that would have on you. I remember how much I respected my campus minister and his wife when I became a Christian. And then an even more prominent staff couple divorced. And then even a very respected Christian counselor. They're all in the same church, all got divorced. What does that say? What's the message?
When you've also been told that, you know, you're going to have the best marriage, the best sex, because you abstain from having anything or any communication, any contact, and this is the right marriage, and this is God's way to do it. And it totally turns people upside down. It's very, very sad.
Very disillusioning. Well.
And I think, honestly, you're talking about sexual unfaithfulness, but I think it's a very narrow view often of sexual harassment. And there has been a lot of sexual harassment, even with staff women in the church. But right. It always comes down to, oh, there wasn't intercourse, so there's no grounds for a dismissal. Yeah, it was impure, but it really wasn't that bad. And or, this kind of stuff
is... Or that staff member's so effective, we can't afford to lose them, you know, we'll just move into another city.
Right. But that whole sense that women then are told, oh, you need to accept what's coming your way because you probably didn't dress the right way.
Do you want to talk about divorce among young people? You know, we're talking about leaders and stuff.
I think just... maybe we should deal with divorce at another time.
Yeah,
I think,
we can do it
because
it's
getting
let's move towards the conclusion here. We certainly believe we need to take sexual sin seriously, and you should too. But there are other behaviors that contradict the will of God that would count as impure. Impurity is much broader than just sexual lust. Did you want to read 1 John 2:15-17?
Yes. Do not love the world or the things in this world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. For all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life, is not of the Father, but is of the world. And the world is passing away, and the lust of it, but he who does the will of the Father abides forever.
Thank you. So here you can see in 1 John, lust is not just a sexual thing. It could be a desire. It's a strong, it's an inordinate desire for things. It could be for luxury or riches or status. It's much broader than sex. And so in purity culture, I think, has done us a great disservice. And it's allowed other sins to flourish while making men and women feel bad about themselves, often when there was really no need to.
Well, I think that's really true. I think we've totally missed the boat when it comes to materialism and consumerism. And usually that's linked right there in the Bible with sexual sin.
Right.
About not being greedy, but we accept that easily.
Well, I wanted to read a passage in Colossians 2 before I make a couple of suggestions. And I think this applies to purity culture very well. And please don't, we're not trying to say that those who take sin seriously or give guidelines are misguided in doing that. But guidelines should be in accordance with what the scripture says. The terms that we use, the advice, the timing, and this is all done with respect for people. And
not with a view to shaming someone or blaming them, or even naming them, making them feel isolated from the body.
Or making them feel like I'm weird because I have these impulses. And particularly with younger people, you know, with teens up until the 20s, wow.
Yes, it's really, I think for a lot of it's caused significant emotional damage.
Left the church, they felt, I can't be a salesman for Christ. I think thousands have left because they feel, I'm just not pure enough, or...
Yes, I'm not good enough.
Or this is just too weird. Well, in Colossians 2, Paul says, since you died with Christ to the elemental spiritual forces of the world, why, as though you still belong to the world, do you submit to the world's rules? Do not handle, do not taste, do not touch. These rules, which have to do with things that are all destined to perish with use, are based on merely human commands and teachings. Such regulations, now think about purity culture, indeed have an appearance of wisdom with their self-imposed worship, their false humility, their harsh treatment of the body, but they lack any value in restraining sensual indulgence. And that is probably the verdict on the purity culture movement itself.
Yeah.
It's nowhere near as effective as thought and may be actually harmful.
In a lot of ways, it's going from the outside trying to affect the inside. Whereas what we need to be working on is the inside that will reflect in our outside behavior.
Well, before we end, just a couple recommendations. You'll find these are all linked in the notes. One is the interview I referenced with Kristen Kobitume on Jesus and John Wayne. I think that's quite relevant to what we're discussing. You may enjoy that. I thought the book by Townsend and Cloud, Boundaries, When to Say Yes, How to Say No to Take Control of Your Life, is important because non-toxic masculinity and femininity have a lot to do with appropriate boundaries. Boundaries itself is a very important book, but it's one
also another one, Boundaries in Marriage, which I think
Boundaries in Marriage.
There are a lot of series, but they're very good in understanding our misunderstandings.
But the initial Boundaries book, as some of you may know, was banned in many churches in the Church of Christ, and you'll realize why, because of control issues. I've got also here Guy Hammond's great book, Caring Beyond the Margins, about homosexuality, A Church Called Tove by Scott McKnight and Laura Berenger, Guilt and Grace, A Psychological Study, if you want something academic, another book on Christian shame and religious trauma. Actually, that's an article. And then this book itself, I keep referencing, Non-Toxic Masculinity. Brothers, read this book. I've got the link for that as well.
Oh, I would say sisters too. I think it really helps get our head around where our head has been, unfortunately.
Okay. Well, we hope this has been helpful to you. I had no idea this would be in our conversations, but in recent weeks it came up again and again, and then I got this book, and we developed a conviction, and things got they started to crystallize in our
minds.
Yes,
that it really has started as a conversation between us and what we've seen and experienced.
So we wanted to share that with you. So thanks for listening.
Goodbye. Thank you.
Bye.